Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming and taking time out of your busy lives and out of a lovely summer's evening almost, but certainly a very spring bright evening. But we're delighted to have someone here who's going to shed light on medical education and the GMC. We would extend a very, very warm welcome to Professor Sir Peter Rubin, who is the chair of the GMC and has a wealth of many interesting activities in his life's work, and I'm sure it is life outside of medicine as well that I know less about. But he is currently the chair of the GMC. He's also Professor of Therapeutics at Nottingham University, and he's also a consultant physician in Nottingham Hospital. He works with medical students, he works with doctors, he works with patients, and he works with all sorts of medical people who may or may not cause problems. And not only that, he has also worked with veterinary surgeons over the years and pharmacists and pharmacologists. So I look forward to hearing what he is going to say this evening, and I would invite him to come and speak to us just now. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Well, hello everybody, and it's really nice to be back here again. I come to Belfast two or three times a year, or come to Northern Ireland two or three times a year, and it's really nice to be here. And this is, I think, unique in my experience, and it's not rained all day. And it looks very nice when the sun shines, doesn't it? I'm often told by people, usually of a certain age, that doctors aren't what they used to be. And I'm going to explore this theme with you this evening. It used to be so simple, didn't it? A doctor was a handsome young man with hair, and nurses were pretty young women who were shorter than doctors. And everyone knew where they stood, didn't they? It was all so straightforward. And then everything went spiralling downhill. You know, this is in the BMJ. The doctor today, they can't take a history, can't do a physical examination, and rely entirely on lab results. Boomed the BMJ in 1944. A lot of the people who go on to me about, you know, standards are just spiralling down, are people of my kind of age. I graduated in 1974. But actually, we, it seems, were rubbish. 1975, the BMJ is concerned about the poor quality of medical students at the point of graduation. That was us, you know. But to understand how really serious things have become, you have to look at this. You really know that the rot has well and truly set in. So, I think of all the things that I am beaten around the head about, and this was particularly true when I chaired the GMC's Education Committee, it was anatomy teaching. My goodness, have the standards dropped. You know, the time was when allegedly we could name all those funny little bones in the hand that I never did quite get to grips with. The cartoon I like best about anatomy teaching comes from the Times, which I'll leave you to read yourself. And what prompted this was that a long retired surgeon had primed a couple of journalists from the Today programme to go into St George's Hospital Medical School and ask students anatomy questions that no right-minded student would know the answer to. If you knew the answer, you were sad. You know, you were reading books or something dangerous like that. And you know, they asked the questions and clearly they didn't know the answers. But actually, you go back and then 1976, the BMJ is going on about the concern about anatomy teaching in Britain. And going back to 1911, to the Haldane inquiry into the University of London, the great American educational reformer, Abraham Flexner, he was tearing anatomy teaching in the UK to pieces. It was rubbish. So you get these same themes coming up again and again and again. It was all so much better before. When you try and find the golden age, when things are so much better, it's surprisingly elusive. And particularly when you try and find real hard evidence. Some of the best evidence comes from the last Royal Commission on Medical Education, which was in the 1960s, 1968. And they did a survey, a very robust survey, of final year medical students in the UK, nearly 2,000 of them. Over 50% were completely hacked off with medicine and were thinking of not doing medicine as a career. And a third were thinking of leaving the country, and did. Now, whether the same third did, but they did. They did. A really interesting thing happened in the 60s and the 70s. Canadian doctors went to America, British doctors went to Canada, Indian and Pakistani doctors came to Britain. And a third of the numerical equivalent of a third of every graduating class from the UK emigrated. Those are the good old days that people go on about. When I graduated, doctors were so happy we were going on strike. Some of you will remember UMTs, units of medical time. Doctors were going on strike about units of medical time. And I was talking the other day to the annual dinner of the BMA Junior Doctors Committee, and I was thinking that actually they're pretty tame these days. Actually, they think they're strident and activist. They're actually pretty tame compared to the way things were back in the 70s, when everyone, of course, was going on strike in the 70s. It was the thing to do, wasn't it? And you've got the concerns again and again, repeated again and again, you know, including very recently in the correspondence columns of the Times from certain long retired people, that doctors of today lack experience. And John Took, in his inquiry into modernising medical careers, was very explicit about this and was very critical of the lack of flexibility in postgraduate medical training. But John didn't get there first, strangely enough. And when Sir George Pickering did his survey in 1978, this is when I was, and many of you would have been in postgraduate training, we were apparently in a straitjacket compared to his day. Now, I didn't feel like I was in a straitjacket at all, but that's how he viewed it comparing to his day. Young doctors had so much more experience back then. In some ways we did. Like the best definition that I've seen of experience is from a previous council member of the GMC, actually. And this is the definition of clinical experience. And of course, that goes to the heart of something which is crucial in understanding all the issues around European Working Time Directive and so on. Experience and training are simply not the same. And I do not agree with the president of the Royal College of Surgeons of England, who is arguing very, very strongly that we should go back to very long hours. I mean, John Black, in fairness, is not saying we should go back to hopelessly long hours. But the thing is, there is a difference between experience and training. This was first brought home to me in a most stark way when I went from being a registrar in the NHS in Stoke-on-Trent, where I'd be banging through, you know, a trillion patients in the clinic in one room, and the consultant would be banging through a trillion patients in the next room. And we'd be doing it in parallel. And I wasn't being trained. I was seeing lots of patients. I then went to Stanford University in California as an American Heart Association fellow. And I did one clinic a week. And it's funny, my career has now gone full circle because I'm doing one clinic a week. I did one clinic a week in hypertension. And on my first clinic, I pitched up, and the attending physicians said to me, "Now, Peter," she said, if you see more than three patients this morning, you've seen too many patients." And she didn't do the first contact. She sat in the library. So I'd see a patient, the other fellows were seeing patients. I'd see the patient, take a long time over it, go into the library, talk to her. She would talk me through it. She'd draw my attention to some recent article in the New England Journal, suggest I read this, read that. She would then come back with me to see the patient, who then got what they were paying for, which was a Stanford opinion. And I'd move on to the next patient. And I thought, wow, this is training. So there's a difference between experience and training. And of course you need experience, of course you do. But you've got to be trained first. Because if you're not, you could be getting experience of doing the wrong thing over and over and over again. And there's a significant difference there. And I think that is so often lost in all the noise around medical education. Well, on the theme of doctors aren't what they used to be, I think there are certain things that happened in history which means that doctors are not what they used to be in all sorts of ways. And one is the creation of the GMC. I mean, you'd expect, doing the job I'm doing, you'd expect me to say that GMC has some passing importance in this. But why do we have a GMC? We kind of take it for granted now. But why do we have it? Well, there were a number of drivers for change in the mid-1800s. A lot of people calling themselves a doctor and they weren't. A lot of people, including the Archbishop of Canterbury, could give a medical degree, and he still can. But we've taken the precaution of not listing it in the Medical Act. But he really genuinely still can, and did. The most recent was given three or four years ago. There was, in the mid-Victorian era, a lot of advances in science, and medical teaching was just not keeping pace. rising liberal sentiments and feelings against monopoly and privilege, and there was widespread perception that the medical royal colleges and their presidents were incompetent. Not a lot's changed there then. And if there's one, there were a lot of people who claim credit for establishing the GMC, but above all else is the founder of the Lancet, Thomas Wakeley or Wackley, depending on who you believe. He was a surgeon, and he felt passionately that there should be a medical regulator. Passionately that there should be a medical regulator. He really had the colleges in his sights. And when asked why he thought there should be a medical regulator, it was to do away with. And that was one of the milder comments he made about the medical royal colleges. But he realised that he was getting nowhere. And he thought, well, the only way that I can get what I want is to get inside Parliament, not be making a lot of noise outside Parliament. So he became an MP, purely to get the GMC. I mean, this is a commitment. And he was in Parliament, and it was not a rapid business. 16 bills, 2 select committees, over 18 years. So in comparison, the revalidation, we're motoring. We really are moving along. And there were all sorts of reasons why bills would fail and everything. And there were 2 select committees. As I said, the select committee of 1848 lamented that the profession was unable to speak with a coherent voice and that the colleges were failing to provide adequate leadership. Some of you in the room may think, I've seen those words before somewhere. And you have to wind forward to the Select Committee inquiry into modernising medical careers. And the secretariat who was supporting that must have thought, hang on a minute, there's one we prepared earlier here. And they said that the profession is unable to speak with a coherent voice and the college not provide adequate leadership. And when you have an interest in history, it is extraordinary how people are determined to repeat the mistakes of others over and over again with great determination. One reason why the bills often fell at the last hurdle is that the civil service then, as the civil service now, had their own ideas, and they were particularly interested in having a national licensing exam, what they called a single portal of entry to the medical profession. And it was seen off by an unlikely alliance of Scotland and the medical royal colleges. The principle, it was as strong then as it is now, I think. But the reason it was seen off by this unholy alliance is shown on this graph. Scotland had medical schools in universities giving degrees for a very long time. And not for the first time and not for the last, the Scots said to the English, we do not want an English answer to a non-Scottish problem. Thank you very much, guys. The colleges, this is the number of docs going on to the percentage of docs going on to the medical register who did so through a University of London degree as distinct from a college licence. In other words... giving a college license was a nice little earner, and the colleges were not going to get rid of that in a hurry. And so this pincer movement saw off the national exam, and therefore saw off bill after bill after bill, until finally the Prime Minister in 1858 could not face a 17th bill coming before Parliament, and in July of 1858 he banged heads together. It's like, I've had it with this thing, I've had it. Let's just find some compromises and get on with it. And in 1858, the Medical Act was passed and was duly recorded in the Times of that year. And it says the object is to establish a register which would distinguish the qualified from the unqualified. And at its heart, that's what we do to this very day. Much more sophisticated. But at its heart, why are we here? That's why we're here, to maintain a register. Strangely, this was not the top news story of 1858. You might think it would be, wouldn't you? The top news story of 1858 was a number of banks going bust because of dodgy deals in America. And it got so bad that the Prime Minister and the Governor of the Bank of England decided to leak to the Times a letter written by the Governor to the Prime Minister. It's interesting. We know that people are worried about the number of banks going bust in England and Scotland. And then it goes on to say, but you know, we, the banking arena, will stand behind the economy, basically. Where the Scots get their reputation for financial prudence, I will never know. Because then, as now, it was the Scottish banks leading the charge into financial oblivion. And what they were doing was that, unlike Vanderbilt and Stanford, who were investing in railroads that went from where people lived to where they wanted to go, the Scottish banks were investing in railroads that went from where no one particularly lived to where no one would want to go. And unlike today, where we've got the big banks, you know, there were many small banks, and they were falling over like dominoes. It dominated the time. We talk about the Times, and the archives available online. That's what I've seen, but dominated the news in 1857 and 1858. But interestingly, it did not lead to regulation of the banking system. And I've had an interesting exchange with the archivist at the Bank of England, who's confirmed this, and he said, for all the noise, all the disasters, all the bankruptcies, there was still no appetite for regulating the financial system, because entrepreneurial zeal in the mid-Victorian era was thought to be too important. You shouldn't hold it back. But at the very same time, Parliament thought, hang on a minute, doctors, we'd better make sure doctors are all right. Interesting, isn't it? Since 1858, the GMC has been actively involved in medical education. We were originally called the General Council for Medical Education and Registration. That was our title. And medical education was the thing. And over all these years, each of these years is a year where we published our guidance on medical education. And some of these years are worth just noting. 1867, we actually defined, I think unintentionally maybe, but defined what is a regulator. The purpose, it said, is to define minimum standards for the protection of the public. And that's a pretty good definition of a regulator, isn't it? In 1885, a very important principle was introduced. This one was, here is the curriculum. You know, you'll do the anatomy of the leg and whatever, you know. In 1885, there was a major policy change which existed to this very day, which is that the regulator sets the overarching principles and we leave it to the medical schools to decide how to deliver on the outcomes. And what I like to call the Rothsay principle. And it is that we say the equivalent of, we want you to get to Rothsay, but whether you do it the quick route or the slow route, we don't bother so much, as long as you get there. And that is the principle that has been there since 1885. 1922, of course, went up from 4 years to 5 years because there was so much to learn. Tomorrow's doctors, I'll allude to a bit later. And many, many times, wringing of hands about overcrowding of the medical curriculum. Note the first time that there was worries about overcrowding the medical curriculum was 1885, and it's been a worry ever since. So I would argue that one reason why doctors are not what they used to be is that actually they are doctors now. You know, any of us who call ourselves a doctor, we can do so because we're on the medical register. And that marks us out from those who are not. So yeah, doctors aren't what they used to be. There's a second reason why doctors aren't what they used to be. And it's to do with this very boring looking, very grey report of the Interdepartmental Committee on Medical Schools. Doesn't get much, much more exciting than this, does it? The chairman was a banker, Sir William Goodenough, who was an Oxford history graduate. He joined Barclays Bank straight from university and stayed there for the whole of his career. And at the time that he chaired this committee, he was the chairman of Barclays Bank Dominion and Colonial Office. One or two of you may even remember that. He was a master of foxhounds. He looks the quintessential establishment gent, doesn't he? But behind that waistcoat beat the heart of a radical. And his report was indeed radical. But to understand quite why he was so successful in coming up with a radical report, you've got to see the context of the time. This was published in 1944. In other words, against the backdrop of the Second World War. The context was developed and provided by Sir William Beveridge. He was a very eminent economist and a civil servant who at the time of his famous report was the master of University College Oxford. He was very free with his advice to the coalition government, the last coalition government, on the need for social reform. And his advice was not entirely welcome. And the government did what governments do. They established a committee, they made him chairman, and they gave him terms of reference so restrictive that there was no risk of them doing any harm whatsoever. But they underestimated Beveridge enormously. He realised there was a war on, and people's minds were kind of elsewhere. But they also underestimated Beveridge in that he understands the power of the news media. And the mandarins in Whitehall simply did not. And when this report was published, while the intention of the civil service was that it would be gratefully accepted and put on a shelf wherever it gathered dust, people were actually queuing around the block to buy it. So as an attempt to suppress something, it was not exactly a spectacular success. And an opinion poll carried out 2 weeks after the Beveridge report was published found that 95% of the British population knew of his report and about 94.5% agreed with its contents of social reform. But even given the quality and amazing vision of the report, timing is everything. And this report was published in the first week of December 1942. Britain had been at war for 3 years. There's been grinding failure, defeat after defeat. And then in November 1942, the British 8th Army in North Africa, El Alamein, defeated the German Army. And the British population, for the first time, thought, there will be peace one day. There will be victory. There will be peace. And then they began to think, well, what are we fighting for here, exactly? We're fighting for the education that I never had, the free healthcare that I never had. And this is encapsulated in a cartoon from The Spectator of just before Christmas, 1942, where all of this is rolled together. A soldier in the desert, 8th Army, drinking a toast to Beveridge and his brave new world. It was against this, and I should say that when I gave this talk to a lay group who were of advanced years, shall we say, at the end of it, a guy came down to me and he said, I was a lieutenant in Aden when this happened, and this was just what my troops said. That's what they were fighting for. Really interesting bit of oral history, you know. So it was against this backdrop that the banker, William Goodenough, was preparing his report on what sort of medical schools do we need post-war to produce doctors for this new visionary National Health Service. And what Goodenough came up with was absolutely radical. A dramatic reform of the whole system, degrees, not college licenses. And you know, to get a sense though, even in 1933-37, still most people got onto the register through a conjoint degree, a conjoint diploma from the colleges. And these provided 50% of college income. So you can imagine what a battle it was to get the college diplomas out and university degrees in. He also introduced the pre-registration year, professorial appointments, major specialties. He emphasised the need for comprehensive, organised postgraduate education. There should be a drastic overhaul of the curriculum, etc., etc. But then you get to the two really big things about why I think this is why doctors aren't what they used to be. First is, medical schools should be co-educational. I mean, we're talking radical here. Medical schools should admit women, to be clear about this, you know? Women to medical school. And the sense of the enormity of this is shown in this slide, which is the female medical students in Edinburgh in 1938, and the total number of female medical students, Guy's, Bart's, St Mary's, I could go on, but I ran out of space on the slide. This is radical stuff. The second thing that the banker, William Goodenough, said Unsuitability for a medical career should be the sole barrier to admission to medical school. And combined with the Education Act of 1944, that opened the way for people like me, first member of my family to go to university, people like me to go to medical school. And a combination of women and lower social class people going to medical school, of course doctors aren't what they used to be. And that has this report, although like so much took years to implement, this report has had a dramatic effect on medical education to this very day. To this very day. As a medical profession, we're a funny bunch. Individually, we're often very innovative, forward-thinking, want the latest gizmos, you know. Put us together collectively, and my goodness, are we conservative. And the Royal College of Surgeons of England responded to the Good Enough Report by saying this, College responsible for standards. Let's not have women in the London medical schools. In the same file in the National Archives in Kew, in the same file is this wonderful letter, which just exudes pomposity and arrogance. In the same file as this letter is a shedload of letters from pushy middle-class parents to their MPs saying, my bright, high-achieving daughter did not get into medical school. The rugby-playing Dumbo down the road did. What are you, MP, going to do about it? And when you're an elected MP, it's a bit of a no-brainer what you're going to do about it, actually. And what the government did was very clever. It said to the London medical schools, well, you know, you're independent institutions. You can do what you like. And when you want taxpayers' money again, let us know. Yeah. Sometimes you don't need complex strategies and working parties. You just get them where you know it's going to, you know. The GMC, something mentioned change. When the council of the GMC considered this watershed report, what did they say? Let's not be getting into all this change stuff when medical students of today can't write English, you know, do they know where to put the apostrophe in it? No, they don't. That is what the council said in response to the Good Enough Report. The government couldn't believe it. The file notes, the little, because we'll lose all this with emails, the little file written notes in the archives is brilliant, you know, brilliant. About, you know, it's the 1940 equivalent of what planet are these guys on, you know. But eventually, in 1946, the GMC were persuaded to go to what they describe in the minutes of the council as the new world. And off they go. And they come back with this report to council. And it was all too much bother. All too difficult. And the GMC essentially lost interest in medical education for a good 35, 40 years. It was all too difficult. But upheaval and change continued. There was a meltdown in relationships between the medical profession and the GMC in the 1970s when the GMC introduced an annual retention fee of £2. And it was cataclysmic. Thousands of GPs in particular refused to pay. There was a likelihood that the NHS would grind to a halt because the doctors would lose their registration. The government panicked and established a committee of inquiry headed by Alec Merrison. And this was far-reaching. And amongst other things said, the council of the GMC has abdicated its responsibility for education. There should be a statutory education committee. And also recommended that the GMC should regulate postgraduate medical education. Well, the colleges saw that one off pretty effectively. But a GMC education committee was established and then began to motor and published Tomorrow's Doctors, which introduced 50 years on, much of what had been recommended in the report of 1944. But actually was introducing stuff that the most progressive medical schools, like Newcastle, like Nottingham, were doing anyway. I think we've got to remember that. This was happening anyway. But Tomorrow's Doctors was another watershed, and another reason why doctors aren't what they used to be, because it explicitly said there's more to medicine than the science. It's about communication, it's about listening, it's about team working. It was tomorrow's doctors that began to enshrine that in the culture of medical education. And that, in my view, is another reason why doctors aren't what they used to be. It also introduced a really important concept in medical education. Until that time, there'd still been this mindset that you had to produce the omnicompetent, independent practitioner. Tomorrow's doctors finally did away with that and said, okay, we're doing two things here. Of course, we're training people for the horizons we can see, but we're educating them for what we can't see beyond the horizon. And it's very explicit about that, and again, introduced a cultural change in medical education. And there's another reason why Dr. Mother used to be, and it can be summed up in one word, which is Bristol. This is the front page, of the front cover of the BMJ in the week in which the GMC's professional conduct hearings ended. This is a mum whose baby had died on the operating table in Bristol, standing outside our previous Hallam Street offices with a little coffin. And Richard Smith, the then editor of the BMJ, in his editorial said, "All change, change utterly." A poem by T.S. Eliot. All change and utterly. British medicine will be transformed by the Bristol case. And indeed it was. Indeed it was. And I think when people come to write the history of medicine in the UK in the last 25, 30 years, I think Shipman, Harold Shipman, will be a footnote. That's not to diminish the evil that he did. And let's be clear, Shipman was evil. But Shipman was a psychopathic murderer. I don't think any of us in this room can really relate to the mind of a psychopathic murderer. Bristol was about looking the other way. You know, and we could all relate to that because we're all human. Which of us in this room has not, at the end of a weekend, at least those of us who work in hospital, at the end of a weekend, which of us hasn't heaved a sigh of relief as some rubbish locum has gone out the door, we're just so delighted that they won't be in our hospital again. You know, we've been there, haven't we? We've been there, if we're honest about it. We've looked the other way. And Bristol was about looking the other way. And I think long before any legislative change happened, Bristol by itself began to change the culture of British medicine and made it more acceptable to say of a colleague, he or she is not up to it. Therefore, resulting in doctors not being what they used to be. It led to the GMC, proposing revalidation. This is the text from the letter from the then president to the Medical Royal Colleges and the BMA, basically saying, we can't go on like this. We can't go on like this. Professional self-regulation has failed spectacularly. And that was the beginning of revalidation. But another thing that happened post-Bristol, as a consequence of Bristol, was in the Bristol report, was this sentence. We were not persuaded that to leave the crucial task of approving and supervising postgraduate medical education to the Royal Colleges alone is in the public interest. Pretty damning stuff. And it's there because the Royal College of Surgeons had failed not once, but twice, to identify the problems in Bristol. And the report, in a forensic way, picks apart the amateur nature of the college reports. And that is another consequence of Bristol, that the colleges had their opportunity. They were given an opportunity in the 1990s to get their act together through the STA, and they failed. They failed. Quite spectacularly failed. And that's what led to PMETB and now the GMC regulating postgraduate medical education. All came from Bristol. And of course the colleges didn't like it, did they? And one thing that Bristol did was to change the dynamic between the medical profession and the legislature. The colleges reacted very badly to being held to account for what they did. And one reason why they reacted very badly was that when you took the lid off things, you found some quite surprising stuff. And it was a very difficult time. But it was all about autonomy and independence, and no one actually questioning your right to do things your way. And that has been a fundamental change as well in terms of doctors not what they used to be. So, you know, doctors aren't what they used to be. this is, you know, a caricature, but, you know, we can see it coming. Doctors aren't what they used to be in many, many ways. However, in ending, I would like to argue that despite all that I've said, and doctors are clearly very different to the way we were, and I think most of those changes are very positive, I would argue that although this guy from 1858 and this young lady from very recently may seem worlds apart, him with his microscope, her with her imaging stuff, I would argue that actually there are certain fundamentals about medicine which are timeless, and which mean that doctors in some really important ways are just like we've always been. Because if you say, you know, what do doctors do? Not what does an orthopaedic surgeon do, or an anaesthetist do, or a GP do? What do doctors do, whatever specialty they're in? What do? We synthesize conflicting and incomplete information to make a diagnosis. But it's conflicting and incomplete information. You know, we have to have the intellect and the experience and the training to synthesize this morass of information and make sometimes a life-changing judgment on the basis of incomplete and conflicting information. And doctors do it day in, day out, and have always done so. We deal with uncertainty. Yeah, I've done my share of writing protocols. I think protocols are great. But patients are so unreasonable, aren't they? And, you know, you get a patient coming in with condition A and condition B, and the protocol for condition A will make condition B worse. Well, you know, there should be a rule against it, shouldn't there? And so immediately we're working off protocol. And we work off protocol every day, don't we? You know, it's in the nature of medicine. We work off protocol, and that is what doctors do. We deal with uncertainty. We manage risk. We manage risk. Medicine's a risky business, and that's not said often enough. It's a risky business. One of the worst things we could do as a regulator is discourage doctors from taking reasonable risks, because there's so many people alive today because doctors took reasonable risks. Everyone must understand the risk, not least, of course, the patient. But doctors manage risks, and they, in the conversations that I have with people who, for example, are very keen to introduce airline industry type checklists, which I'm all in favour of. But the fact is that as doctors, we knowingly go into a situation that we know is risky. Whereas airline pilots, by and large, don't. We knowingly go into a situation that's risky, knowing that the risk of death if we don't is high, the risk of death if we do is still high but lower. You know, we manage risk. And doctors have always done this. And finally, we accept personal responsibility for our actions. Now, I would argue that is true of medicine down the ages, and that those of us who practice medicine now are merely the custodians of all this. It was passed, these principles were passed on to us by those that came before us, and we in turn must pass what being a doctor is onto those who come after us. And in ending, and this is my one final slide, in ending, I think this goes to the heart of something that worries me about medical education and curricula, more so postgraduate than undergraduate. But we have got into a situation where we are very focused on achieving competences. And of course doctors must achieve competences. You know, it's blindingly obvious they've got to achieve competences. But I think in the focus on achieving competences is a real risk that we forget what doctors do. And I think that when we think about, well, what footprints do we leave in the sands of time with regard to medical education, I think there's a huge risk that we leave the educational equivalent of knowing the price of everything and value of nothing. That we produce a bunch of technically competent people who are not doctors, because they don't do these overarching, managing risk, dealing with uncertainty, all these overarching things that doctors do. And I feel very strongly that the GMC, as regulator of it all now, has a huge role to play in making sure that the essence of a doctor is enshrined in all medical curricula. So, no, doctors aren't what they used to be in lots of ways, but in some really important ways, doctors are absolutely what they used to be, and long may it remain so. Margaret, thank you very much.
much indeed. I think I could speak for everyone who said that was an extremely interesting talk. And certainly doctors are what they used to be. They aren't what they used to be. They say that general practitioners live in the realm of uncertainty most of the time. Perhaps other doctors do too, more than we think. Questions? I think Sir Peter would be happy to take some. Would anyone like to lead off?
When Margaret asked me to do this, it was made clear to me that she did not want me to talk about, she did not want me to give my usual list of the GMC talk, so I didn't do that.
I heard him speak actually a couple of years ago, and I was quite fascinated by some of the information he gave about what people thought of doctors over the times of change. John?
This is not really a question, but just could I congratulate both of you on, between you, choosing the subject and you, Sir Peter, speaking to it in such a way. I very rarely, I've particularly been asked a bit about what doctors do and their responsibility. I've rarely heard it distilled so succinctly. And
thank you very much.
Marvelous. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
John?
Yeah, I was going to ask, I mean, I would echo exactly what John has just said. That was a superb talk. One of your slides referred, and it was done around the infants to medical school may be slightly better, very different than what they are now. Medical school. I mean, the GMC have a position on the fact that most people who are going to enter medical school are going to have to pay £9,000 a year to even take a medical degree?
We don't have a formal position on that because we don't. We have no statutory remit in terms of admission to medical school. So we're very careful not to get involved in what is clearly a very political argument. As somebody who was a product of the grammar school generation, the first, as I said, first member of my family to go to university, clearly I have personal views on it. And my personal views are that if we don't ensure that the very brightest young people get the very best university education, we fail not only them, we fail the country too. And so, whatever happens with fees and bursaries and scholarships, I personally, it's not GMC policy, but personally, I think it is absolutely fundamentally important to the future of the country that the brightest young people get the best of university education. I'm not sure that what is happening at the moment is likely necessarily to ensure that.
Perhaps I should declare a conflict of interest before I ask this question, because I have connections with one of the Royal Colleges, which I have now retired from, but I also am a member of this august society, which affects everybody. You see, it's open to us all.
Indeed.
And I go back to a great-grandfather who, before the Medical Act, who was an apothecary.
Wow.
The now disbanded Apothecaries Hall in Dublin, which is in disgrace because it was one of those bad places that didn't teach them properly. And I'm delighted, as John said, in your historical review, because it's most interesting and good for us all. Except one thing.
Yep.
You were identifying the progressive medical schools in the 1950s and 60s. Mm. And those of us who went to this medical school in Belfast knew, because we always knew, that Belfast was a very progressive medical school in those times.
I stand corrected.
Long before Nottingham was even thought of, professor of physiology, David Greenberg.
Indeed, he was a foundation dean.
Well. But my question, and it's a serious question, because you dealt with this in a rather light-hearted and very nice way, is the GMC anti-college?
Oh no. I think that I tried to criticise the GMC and the colleges in equal measure because both were putting their head deeply in the sand and both were failing to realise the world around them had changed. Far from it. My view is that the medical expertise resides within the medical royal colleges. It doesn't reside in the GMC. It resides within the medical royal colleges and in some specialties also within the specialist associations. And you'll be aware that in some specialties, not all, but in some, there is tension between the specialist associations and the relevant royal college. My wish of the medical royal colleges is that I think I can say with some some certainty that the GMC has reinvented itself in the last 10 years or so. We're a very different body to what we were. And I think we've done that because there was a recognition that you either change or you die. And I hope that we're now more attuned to the world around us while maintaining core standards. Now, my concern about the medical royal colleges is that not all of them will do all that is necessary to ensure that they are attuned to the changes in the world around them. And that too many of them will be too anchored to the assumptions of the past, which will not hold true for the future. And I certainly would not want to see the medical royal colleges weakened or diminished. My concern is that postgraduate medical education, I think, is going to become a global market. I think we're going to see providers coming in from outside the UK offering to produce curricula for major specialties and exams for major specialties. And I'm concerned that the medical royal colleges should be in a position to maintain the high reputation that they have, not just in the UK, but throughout the world. So no, most definitely we're not anti-college. What I'm saying is that the GMC has moved the times, some colleges have, but I think all colleges need to recognise the world is constantly changing. If we were starting now, would we have 17 royal colleges and faculties in the UK alone, not including the Irish colleges? And the answer has to be no, we wouldn't. And if you look at the way that the Canadians do it, with a couple of overarching organisations with specialty groupings beneath them, there are economies of scale there which are really important. The very large colleges, of which really, truly, there are only two really, really big colleges, do have lots of money to do things with, but there's a long tail, and the tail includes colleges that struggle to have the sort of staff that, for example, at the GMC, I take for granted. I take for granted the support I get at the GMC from really bright people writing briefings, analysing government policy. The smaller colleges don't have that. So having a large college overarching would give the economies of scale, which could well be the answer. But, you know, you and I both know, you know, improbable, isn't it?
When Sir John spoke to us a year or so ago, he expressed concern about role substitutes. Is the GMC concerned about role substitutes?
Now, do you mean by that nurse practitioners, physician assistants,
and physician
so on?
Physician assistants and podiatric surgeons.
Yeah, I am not concerned about other health professions doing what they may well do better than doctors do. What I'm concerned about is not confusing a nurse endoscopist with a gastroenterologist, because nurse endoscopists will be very good at working to protocol. Gastroenterologists are the people that would be working off protocol and dealing with the complications. I mean, 30 years ago, I started in Glasgow a nurse practitioner-run hypertension clinic, which worked really well, because there are some things nurses do much better than doctors do, and taking blood pressure accurately and recording it is one of them. And so the nurse practitioner ran the clinic really well, but we were always there to see patients who were off protocol. That, I think, is what doctors are for. So unlike John, and I know John took very well, unlike John, I'm not concern, provided that there is absolute clarity about the difference in the roles and where the buck stops, that stops with the doctor.
Thank you for that excellent lecture. I have a question, but first, the beverage report, which I had some interest in a few years ago, just to add to what you were saying, as I'm sure you know, the beverage report was the best-selling government document ever published in this country. Second most popular was the Denning report on the placebo. Contrary to what many people think, Beveridge did not actually use the phrase from the cradle.
Indeed.
It was used in the Daily Express, I think, the next day. Mm. And then Churchill, who made a speech on radio about 6 months later, he didn't much like Beveridge, but knew it popular. Obviously, when he sold it, used it again. And
indeed.
But the question I want to ask you about is, you described very well the role of the doctor. And yet, there seems to be a huge lack of public understanding of this. lack of understanding in the media, particularly with respect to what you said about risk. How can we try and get that corrected? Because really,
I think we all have a huge role to play here. We, the regulators, the medical world colleges, we all have a huge role to play here, because the public doesn't understand risk in general. You know, in general. And we have a huge role to play in explaining that medicine is a risky business, but there can be big benefits from taking risks, but can be bad consequences from taking risks. And it's not going to be a simple or overnight thing, but I think all of us have to be giving the same message and explaining it in terms that the whole diversity of the population will understand, and that's a huge challenge. You know, all of us have been in the position, I'm sure, of sat there explaining something to someone, thinking they've understood it, and it becomes obvious that they're too late, they haven't had a clue what we were talking about, despite the fact we think we've done it, you know, before. So, no, I agree, Bob, I think it's a huge issue, and I don't have a simple answer to it, other than that, we've got to take it really seriously.
Two more questions. First, Colin Ratson, Jack.
Thanks very much for the talk. Thank everybody, that was brilliant. The question I want to ask is just, you made a comment at the end that the doctors, current day doctors, the future doctors, tend to be very well educated, but they sometimes don't value their role as a doctor. And you were saying that the GMC were going to maybe take that on as part of your role. How do you plan to inspire this generation of young doctors and actually get them to value the fact that they are qualified as a doctor, and not to burn out as some people seem to do now, because they haven't really understood the nature or the value of the job that they're getting into?
I don't want to pretend that I've got an easy answer to this, but I haven't. What I do know is that we've gone the competency route, partly because it's easy to do so, and we're measuring things we can measure. And as I said, I must emphasise, I'm as keen as anybody in ensuring that doctors are competent, you know, in whatever technical area they're in. But my view, and I'll be pushing this very, very strongly within the GMC, as we consult, as we will do, on our new approaches to mental education, just because something's difficult to teach and to measure doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. And I will want to see, in every curriculum, the overarching issue of this is what a doctor is. That comes above everything else. It comes above whether an orthopedic surgeon can replace the hip or not. It is the doctor. It is being able to put in a coronary artery stent is one thing. Knowing whether you should do it or not is quite another matter. And that goes to the heart of the difference, doesn't it? And I want that to be the ability to take risks, the ability to know when not to take risks, the dealing with uncertainty. All that, I just want to see explicitly there as the top level, most important thing of what's the purpose of this educational program, this person's veteran bar club, that is it. Right up there. It's not going to be easy though, and the reason I'm making such a big noise about it is I think we're in danger of losing it, unless we grab it back now.
Jack?
I think, Sir Peter, that was a very interesting question, that last one. I'm sure we could go on all night about it. But 1997 and the beginning of revalidation seems a lifetime away now.
To us too, yeah.
Can you update us about the time frame, about when it is actually part of doctors' lives? I know that they're building towards it.
Autumn 2012. All four governments have signed up for autumn 2012. We could start revalidation in a number of specialties, a number of locations around the UK tomorrow, quite frankly. You know, the pilot sites, a number of areas here in Northern Ireland, for example. You know, we could start tomorrow. So the key thing for us is to get going and start. We're not going to start everywhere on day one. It's not going to be a big bang for the whole country. But we'll start and it'll be then phased in over the next 2 to 3 years. So autumn 2012 is when it's going to start.
Thank you very much indeed. I think we could ask you many more questions, but I think we'd better give you a chance to gather your breath.
Thanks very much, Margaret.
Thank you again. I have a couple of housekeeping points to make. I can't say thank you. thank you enough to Sir Peter, but I hope that maybe he will take some more informal questions over a cup of tea or coffee downstairs, and I hope you'll all stay to join an informal discussion over that. John Craig is our secretary. He has asked me to remind you that there is a golf competition for the Ulster Medical Society on the 12th of May this year, and he would be very keen to speak to anyone, or if anyone speak to him, who would be interested or who might bring friends to join in that. John is there, I think everybody knows him. So please, would you think about it and get in touch with him as soon as possible. There are some certificates of attendance at the end that will be useful for your evaluation folders in due course. And I'd be very, very happy if everyone who's here would actually sign either the members' book in the visitors' column, the members' column, or the fellows' column. And thank you again for coming. This is the last of our winter series for this year, and I look forward to seeing you again in the autumn, if not the golf competition. Thank you.